The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We've got Jim calling in from the remote studio to handle our questions for today. As usual, I think we're going to dive into some Social Security issues up front and then pull out of the grab bag and see what we get here. So thanks for joining me, Jim. He's muted, so he can't talk.
I got it. I was testing you to see if you knew I was muted.
The dead silence is what gives it away.
The dead silence was a giveaway. The other day, we're doing a conference call. Mm-hmm. It's me, Junior. I think it was Sean and one other person. And I forgot that I put them on mute. And I'm trying to interrupt and talk and say things. And they're just going on, mm-hmm. and I'm starting to get mad. I'm like, will you guys let me say something? And then I realized my phone was on mute. So good thing they didn't know. They would have been laughing. But you can't tell when a phone's on mute. Nobody can see. And I had totally forgotten that I muted the phone. But I was getting frustrated because they weren't listening to what I was trying to say.
That's a classic Jim right there.
That's a Jim move, exactly. Yeah. People might be saying, why do I want to hire this guy to help me do my retirement planning?
Well, don't hire him for tech support. Let's just say that.
No, you do not want me for tech support. Yet the funny thing is I go home and everyone thinks, I must have my family confused, or not confused, that's a bad word, totally tricked into thinking I'm some tech expert because they all ask me these tech questions, especially my mom. But I keep trying to tell them, I don't know. I don't know why everyone thinks I know. I don't know anything.
I'm not sure either, Jim.
I have no idea. Talk about something, gardening and talk about that. Hunting, fishing, stuff I know. Tech, I don't know. Yeah. All righty. Anyways, folks, we're going to get into it. This is an EDU show.
No, it's a Q&A show.
You got the Q's, we got the A's. So on this show, again, we answer your questions. We're going to begin. Normally, we begin with a Social Security question. And I guess you could say, Chris, we technically are beginning with a Social Security question. But it really has to do with an Q&A show that we answered last week for a physician client. It did elicit a few comments and a little bit of confusion. So we wanted to clear the air on what we meant. So I know you have one of the emails and I have one of the emails. Someone emailed you directly. Did you want to read that one or you just want to give a summary of what this thing was? You want me to read mine?
I don't know that we need to read them necessarily. Maybe some elements of yours. But in essence, we got a few emails that they didn't think we focused enough on the survivorship aspect of the physician's age 70 benefit. So quick recap for those of you who didn't hear last week's show, had someone who had emailed us that were planning to claim at 70, but was talking to a Social Security person, and they mentioned, you have a minor child. Did you know you could collect a minor child benefit if you filed for your own benefit? And he was considering then filing immediately instead, which was, I think he was 68 or getting ready to turn 68. And we talked about kind of the pros and cons of foregoing his original plan of claiming at 70 to pick up that child benefit that he could get earlier on. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and they're not particularly important. The punchline of what I had talked about personally was that I felt that the benefits of the child benefit weren't nearly enough to overcome the claiming at 70 issue. Now, or the claiming at 70 original plan. And I came to that conclusion mainly because the break even on that simple question was 6 years. That after 6 years, the age 70 benefit will have overcome the amount that he would have collected from the survivor benefit. Now, that maybe wasn't the whole story. But that was intentional, actually. The people that emailed in were alluding to, well, you didn't focus on the survivor benefit. And one even mentioned the break-even on the waiting till age 70 concept. We don't like applying a simple break-even to that because if you listen to the show much, you realize that we're fans when it can be pulled off, when you have enough other resources, that waiting to 70 to claim the largest benefit between the couple is going to create a nice survivor benefit that will last as long as either of you lasts. So there's benefit, I think, in longevity protection. So protection against that thing we call longevity risk. And so we don't try to play the break-even game, you know, guessing, are you going to live past 84? And if you're not, you should claim earlier. If you think you are, you should claim later. Well, the think you are, I think, is where you get into trouble. And so we don't do that. And so I didn't mention kind of that broader break-even question. I was looking at just the child benefit. How long would it take you to have gotten the extra money back to cover that child benefit? Now, he did claim his own benefit a couple of years earlier. But that, in my mind, was more the base, should I claim at 70 decision, completely separate from the claiming the child benefit. I would agree with the people who emailed that you could look at it more broadly than that. I think I would stand by our ultimate conclusion, and you came at it a little direct. You probably focused a little bit more on the survivor benefit, but ultimately we mentioned that the only way to know for sure what's the right way to go would be to do a plan. I can't tell you whether that survivor benefit is of use to that particular client and his spouse without a plan. So sometimes it doesn't make sense to wait till 70, or the benefits really aren't enough to justify it. So I could understand where you could look at it more broadly than that. Or the punchline was continue to claim at age 70. If you're going to play the break-even game overall, then you could certainly make the case for claiming it early, because that the math does shift to favor the claiming early scenario when it's not just you getting the benefit early, but you plus some extra benefit, that child benefit. That's going to push the break-even point out past the normal median mortality age break-even point. So I didn't focus so much on that broader question, because ultimately he was planning to wait till 70. So he was looking for a reason to violate that original plan. And I think I concluded that, no, the benefits of that child benefit aren't enough for you to throw in the waste bin the reasons why you were going to claim at age 70 in the first place. But, you know, call me back when he passes away and his wife passes away, and then we'll know what was the right answer there. That's the challenge. You're never going to know till it's too late. I think if you live too long, you're going to experience the regrets of the bad decision. If you live too short, you're not going to regret anything because you're gone. Might be a pessimistic or a kind of a morbid way of thinking about it, but for those of you trying to play the break-even game, it's true. If you pass away before the break-even point, you, quote, lost because you didn't collect as much in Social Security. But do you care? I would say no.
You know, I read an interesting, I'm unmuted, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I read an interesting article in Advisor Perspectives not too long ago on this very discussion. And someone pointed out in the article, if I remembered his name, I'd give him credit. But it was a point that I pondered and still ponder to this day. And I hope I can explain his rationale behind what you just said and what a lot of people think of when they're looking at this break-even period. If the end result on a break-even period, you're worrying about dying, obviously, and I said that on a recent podcast, and everybody on this thread that I was reading, I was agreeing with that. When you're doing a break-even analysis, you're always wondering, what if I die beforehand, I'm going to quote-unquote somehow lose. Mm-hmm. But if you're passed away, what you're really saying is, hey, if I wait to claim my inheritance may not be as large. Is that a good way of looking at it?
That is the one for those people who are standing on claim earlier rather than later. If you think you're not going to make the break even, they, if they're doing the math, are going to point out in the argument. I'll admit this. If I was arguing the other side, I would be pointing out, if you turn on the Social Security, you're not going to drain your assets as quickly, and you'll have died early and leave more behind. Now, I counter that usually with, you're dying early, so you're leaving more behind anyway. How much extra do you want? Do you want a plan around prioritizing the inheritance? If that's true, then that does change the Social Security approach, in my opinion. But not that many people put the inheritance above their own financial well-being, but some people do.
Okay. All right. I was just curious on what your thoughts on that were. Mm-hmm. All righty. So that was one part of what people were questioning us on, but we also were questioned, and I do believe we covered this, perhaps not as clearly as this listener and several listeners who reached out to us, I think, would have preferred. So they said, hi, Jim, this is, and he's using his real name, but we're going to call him George from Maryland. Dear Jim and Chris, I have a comment on episode 2131 with the 67-year-old Floridian physician with a 14-year-old child on Social Security. Then Weedy says, he asked about the idea of claiming Social Security early to collect benefits for a minor child. You both missed a huge, and by you both, I think he meant you, Chris, missed a huge, but he misspelt that. But anyways, you both missed a huge piece of the puzzle. You did not fully account for the longevity benefits of the spouse. I feel the Floridian who is 67 years old but has a 14-year-old, you didn't touch upon the age of the spouse. Given the 14-year-old child, I bet, well, he says she is likely 15 or more years younger than him. Mm-hmm. Or you didn't take into consideration her expected PIA relative to him. If I'm correct, and she's 15 years younger and a stay-at-home mom with a PIA much lower than his, it's a no-brainer that he should wait to 70. Admittedly, they will have enough money no matter what they decide to do. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I want to make mention of this, and we did get several other emails on this, and very good kudos to you, Vanguardi, and do-it-yourselfers picking up on it. But in defense of Chris, I'm going to stick up for him here. In defense of Chris, I did say when it was my turn to talk, and if you remember, Chris, I said I'm going to take a slightly different approach, and I led with folks, he or the family needs to do a retirement analysis first. And the reason I wanted to do that, because I said on the show, I don't know if they need additional secure income or not. He had a pension, and if my memory serves me correct, he had a small annuity, and he had Social Security. And I wanted to determine, do you need additional guaranteed income? If so, you will wait. Now, what I didn't get into and explain, mostly because I took for granted, we do this for a living and we do it all the time. When someone hires us for a retirement analysis, we look at three scenarios. We look at a couple, we look at a widow, and we look at a widower. What happens if she dies first? What happens if he dies first? What happens if they keep living? We analyze those three areas. So it's not that we missed it. It was rolled into that. Seriously, that's how we would look at things. I would hope any competent financial planner you are going to, who's going to try to run a retirement analysis, is going to do an analysis with all three scenarios that I described: a couple, a widow, and a widower. And it's in the plan, listeners, who questioned us on this. It's in that plan where we would have picked up, obviously, if they needed any additional benefits as a spouse or a survivor, should I say, or not. I don't know much about the annuity he had, if it was a joint and survivor. I don't know if the pension was a joint and survivor. There was a lot of missing pieces. Remember, these aren't real clients. They're questions. And yes, sometimes we don't get deep into it. Now, should we have pointed out to him specifically the survivorship? Yes, I think Chris should have done that. And he will try harder next time. But it was rolled in to our desire to do a retirement plan.
Yeah,
what
do you think? I'll admit that I didn't expressly discuss the survivorship. It went through my mind, but my mind jumped kind of past that initial assessment. And that's what I meant by he came to us planning to claim at 70. That I interpreted as he'd done the analysis and decided he liked the survivorship benefits of waiting till 70, which I like this listener's email comment or train of thought that with a 14-year-old child, it's likely that the spouse is much younger, which makes that survivor benefit even more worthwhile because that's, you know, that higher benefit between the two of them is going to last for an extra long time when one spouse is much younger than the other, you know, assuming that the statistics hold true. So I do like his train of thought, but I don't think I need to defend myself so much. I admitted that we didn't dive into that in great detail, but it's because I kind of jumped through that with his coming to us as I planned to wait till 70. So I kind of concluded, well, he determined that was his best bet until he found out about this child benefit. And then the question was really in my mind surrounding, is that enough extra for me to change my train of thought on the age 70 benefit? And I think especially those of us who like that survivor benefit will conclude that no, it wasn't enough extra. Nice to have, but again, I think he had enough moving parts here. This Social Security thing that he's fixating on, this is going back to the original listener that sent in the question. In the grand scheme of things, this might be small potatoes. There might be some other things that he needs to be focused on rather than his precise Social Security claiming strategy. There might be other tax issues or pension issues or other things that need to be addressed that are far more important or impactful on his overall plan than the Social Security. I don't remember all the details of it, but I remember thinking that, you know, this isn't a make or break decision for the most part. But he wanted our opinion, and my conclusion was stick to the age 70.
Okay. I will end with, again, for all listeners listening to this, that may have sounded like a simple question when we first read it last week on the Q&A show, but hopefully you can gather from our answer, our long discussion on that show, our long discussion on this show, the questions coming in. It's actually a more complicated, there's no right and wrong answer. There truly isn't. It needs to be looked at with a retirement plan. He really should get an analysis and look at all these elements that our fine listeners are picking up on also, including the survivorship, the widower. What I originally said, I was wondering if he should claim early and use some of that money to help fund a college education or perhaps take some of that money to leverage. We assumed he might not need the money. If he needed it, he would have turned it on already. So if he didn't need it, maybe he turns it on and leverages it into a second to die guaranteed universal life policy, maybe a single to die policy on him, leaving, if this listener is right, a much younger spouse even a greater inheritance to help her do things. So there's any number of things, Chris, any number of rabbit holes that can go down here. There's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. You need a plan. Don't try to answer questions that seemingly seem simple without a good understanding of what the future may bring, and having the clarity of the future with these different scenarios, what if scenarios, so you can make an educated decision today. So yeah, I want to throw that out there.
Yeah, and just to expand a slight bit more before we go on to the next question, I think that's a common mistake people make in their overall retirement planning, is they try to compartmentalize all the decisions as if they're all small, individual, independent decisions, when in fact a lot of these decisions only make sense in a broader context of the entire plan. You cannot make a self-contained, standalone Social Security decision appropriately, in my opinion. You've got to know how that piece fits into the puzzle, the overall puzzle. You've got to understand the whole picture. That's where the planning element comes in. And that's where you'll be, I think, more assured that you're making the best decision on something like Social Security claiming for yourself.
Okay, perfect. I think we beat that horse to death, and we can move on
and to... continued beating it even after it was dead.
Yes, we're still beating it. Okay. I wonder... this one is a two-part question. I'm going to hold off on this one. I'm going to get to some other questions. Let's continue with the Social Security vein, if you will. Okay, says, hi, Jim. My name is, and we're going to protect his anonymity, he asked, and we'll call him George. Mm-hmm. You haven't seen this question, Chris. So it's actually a donation question. He's got a question on donating to his children. But he begins by laying out his scenario. Both he and his wife are 62. Both were born in 1959. They've got $3.6 million in an IRA, $0.6 million in a Roth, $4.1 million in a taxable, what we call maybe taxable, brokerage account. Mm-hmm. He also has a small HSA earmarked for health expenses, got about... $100,000 in it, $200,000 in his daughter's 529 because she is in medical school and he needs it for that. So obviously can't be used for retirement. It's going to be earmarked for his daughter's medical school. And they have a house worth about $500,000. But all totaled, their liquid assets, the assets they have, are about 8.3 million or so. Mm-hmm. In investable assets for retirement. So he's running into two issues. First has to do a little bit with Social Security. So he's just wondering if you could give him a quick recommendation of when would you recommend my spouse begin collecting her Social Security? Let me give you some background. My Social Security benefit at my full retirement age will be $3,200, but I am going to wait to 70 when it will be $4,033. We'll just call it $4,000. My wife's Social Security benefit at her full retirement age, which is the same as mine, is just $1,650. My wife is retired, but I am semi-retired, still working a little bit and making $55,000 a year, and I'll continue to do this for a couple more years. I have health insurance, and that will pay me until I reach 65. Last year, my earnings were over $200,000, but most of that came from our taxable brokerage account. Mm-hmm. So it's generating, the $4.1 million is generating, he doesn't really say how much of that $202,000 was taxable, but if it's if he made $55,000 this year part-time and he made $55,000 last year part-time, maybe about $145,000 or so, being generated from a $4.1 million portfolio. So he's got two questions. His first is, without going any deeper, what do you think his spouse should do on her Social Security if he is going to wait to 70? They are the same age, and her PIA is $1,650.
Well, she'll never qualify for a spousal benefit, so it's all really a question of when does she want to turn on her own. And I say that because if his PIA is $3,200, the maximum spousal benefit is half of that, or $1,600, and she has her own benefit of $1,650. So there is no spousal offset opportunity here, so it's just a standalone decision for the most part for her. This is another one where with, given these other resources, the Social Security decision is fairly small potatoes. Our basic approach or our default to look at first, and this is where the context of the broader financial plan comes in, we usually look at his claiming at 70, she claims at full retirement age, which would be 66 and 10 months, so we'll call it 67 almost, being born in 1959. Could there be an argument for her claiming at 62? Possibly, but then her benefit is going to be lower if she, if her, her benefit's going to be almost 30% lower if she claims at 62. It won't affect the survivor benefit. Keep in mind that her claiming early would have affected her own and any potential spousal benefit, but I started this reply with there is no spousal benefit in this particular case. So what a lot of people misconstrue, though, is her claiming early will not harm her in the long run claiming a survivor benefit if he predeceases her. If she dies first, hers goes away. She keeps, he keeps his 40, you know, 33, the 4,000 we called it at age 70. If he passes away first, she loses hers and gets his in full as long as she has reached her full retirement age when she claims that survivor benefit. So as long as he dies after she's 66 and 10 months, which, you know, odds are good. So I mean, health is good for both, but do want to mention that. So there's not a permanent harm in her claiming early as far as that ultimate survivor benefit is going to roll out. So, you know, I would say this is going to come down to less of a financial decision and more of a how do you want to look at Social Security. Some people look at it as I want to make sure to extract money as soon as possible without harming my longevity risk protection. Her claiming early probably isn't going to undermine their ability to retire when they're sitting on another $8.3 million unless they have an extraordinarily expensive lifestyle. And if they do, a few extra dollars of Social Security in the long run isn't going to solve that problem. So if they have this urge for her to claim earlier, I'd do it. If later, I would probably not wait till beyond her full retirement age just as a default. But you could argue could be later. Again, they're not going to, quote, need this money. There's going to be full 85% taxability of this. If she continues to work, there's going to be an earnings test if she claims before 66 and 10. But I'd say let your emotions as much as anything drive how you treat hers. I like his waiting. I still think it's a good deal to have this nice, robust foundation of the higher benefit being delayed till 70. But again, with $8.3 million overall, this isn't a make-or-break decision, in my personal opinion. But I think it's prudent to have that foundation of the survivorship benefit, that age 70 for him. So I know that was probably a wishy-washy answer. I mean, he was probably hoping, oh, you should have her claim at 64 and 3 months. that's no way to do that kind of calculation because there is no real calculation that's going to drive that conclusion. I don't think they, quote, need it, so the benefit of delaying is a lot less than normal. So if you want it early, take it early, as long as it's not going to be affected by the earnings test or anything annoying like that. But doesn't sound like there's a tax advantage to earlier or later. They're going to be in the 85% of it being taxable given their circumstances. Do you agree, disagree, Jim, on that?
Nope, I agree. I was doing a calculation when you were chatting, okay. But no, okay. I agree with what you're saying.
Okay.
When I get in, well, the next question, as you will see, it lends a little bit of better understanding of their situation. And I don't feel they need the Social Security benefit. I agree with you 100%. Social Security for them is not the major decisions they need to be making. Mm-hmm. And when I read the rest of his email, I don't think not even receiving Social Security would affect their ability to retire based on what he's sharing. Now, oftentimes the emails, and this one in particular, doesn't have answers to a lot of the questions that you and I would have, so we have to go with the flow. So he continues. Remember I mentioned his adjusted gross income was $202,000 last year, most of which came from his taxable brokerage account. So what I went ahead and did, folks, is I went and figured, okay, if he is earning about $55,000 a year, And let's say he earned that last year and he earned $200,000. So he earned about $145,000 from the taxable brokerage. That's back of the envelope, rough calculation. He has about $8.3 million, that $145,000, folks, was generated from $4.1 million, giving a payout of about 3.54%. Mm-hmm. That was my calculation. So he's earning about 3.5%. It's leading me to think he probably has a lot of dividend-paying stocks with a higher dividend yield. He's certainly not getting the 3.5 with a large fixed income portfolio. So I'm guessing he has a lot of dividend-paying stocks, perhaps some longer-term bonds that are paying a little bit more in income. But he's generating a lot of income. But he also goes on to say, Chris, we live on about $100,000 a year. So you have someone, folks, living on about $100,000, making $55,000, probably only taking about $45,000, Chris, out of the $145,000 that he earned in his taxable brokerage account. So I'm guessing the other $100,000 was reinvested. Maybe if they're dividend-paying stocks, he's in a DRIP plan, dividend reinvestment plan. Maybe they're being reinvested just by buying additional shares if he's not in a DRIP plan. Could be any number of things. I don't know. But what I think is perhaps the basis of that $4.1 million might not quite be as high as a lot of people might think. I don't know what it is, because stock market has been up a lot over the past 12 years, so there still could be a lot of embedded cap gains. I don't know. So without having that info, some of my thoughts from a tax perspective and a planning perspective are in the gray. Everything so far, Chris, makes sense with what I'm sharing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you disagree with any of my assumptions?
Nope, not so far.
Okay. So if he's earning about 3.54%, his question was this. I have three children, age 32, 29, and 22. The 22-year-old is in medical school, hence the 529 I have. They will inherit everything from us. So three children, one in medical school. This man amassed his total net worth is $9.1 million when we include his house. I didn't get into the house because it's not germane to some of the situation here. I don't think he amassed $9.1 million of assets over a working career earning just $55,000 a year. If he did, he should write a book.
Yeah.
So
maybe
so
make a movie.
And I'm guessing he too may have been a physician when I saw that his daughter was in medical school, which makes me wonder, are the other two out of medical school but also physicians? So are we faced with a situation, Chris, where his children, who are going to be the ultimate beneficiaries of his assets, will they be in a very high income tax bracket when they come to inherit the assets? That was a question in the back of my mind.
Especially since it looks like they are on track for these assets to continue to grow. It doesn't, on their current lifestyle, doesn't appear that they're going to be draining them down. And thus, if live long enough, they won't leave a big inheritance. It looks like they are destined to leave a significantly large inheritance behind.
Correct. So he goes on and says, on a recent podcast that you did on gifting, it made me wonder about giving my children money now. What if I gave $1 million each to my children from my taxable brokerage account and just filed Form 709? So if he did that, there would be no gift tax owed under current laws. Under current laws, he could gift $1 million to each child, $3 million from his taxable brokerage account. He doesn't have to sell the shares. They would want to look to see who should pay the taxes. He's only making $55,000. If his other two children are already practicing physicians, they may be making more. So I'm not sure who should ultimately pay the taxes.
You mean who to pay the taxes?
Right. If he goes this route, would he sell and gift cash, or would he give shares and let them sell? That I don't know, and we're not going to get into it on this podcast, but he does have to look at that. Who is going to pay the taxes on the liquidation of the brokerage account into cash? Or maybe his children just want to hold the shares and like them and will continue to hold them and not sell. So, I mean, there's all those other options.
Right. So by that, listeners, when he says pay the tax, he's talking about paying the tax on the gain, on the realized gain on those shares when they're sold.
Not on the gift itself, folks. Right. There will be, under current laws, there will be no gift itself. Right. He is afforded a, what is it now, per
11.7? Something like that.
Mm-hmm. So he has an 11.7 gift and estate tax exempt, 11.7 million gift and estate tax exemption, somewhere around there. It's 11 point something million, each of them, the husband and wife. So 22 million or so. Gifting 3 million, there'll be no taxes owed. And the IRS has made clear, I hope they don't go back on it, but the IRS has made clear, and I tend to believe they're not going to go back on it, or there'll be egg on their face, that they're not going to claw back any gifts made under current laws if the estate tax or gift tax rules are changed in the future. Although I did read an article that allegedly in Biden's tax plan of bringing back the estate tax, he wants to make it, lowering it rather, he wants to make it retro to January 1st of this year. So it's a messy situation there. I don't know what's going on and what would happen. But under current rules, there would be no gift tax owed. And on indication from the IRS anyways, they would not claw it back in. Maybe Biden would claw back in on the estate side and not the gift side. That I don't know. But these are just little wrinkles to his strategy. But right now, there would be no gift tax. Who pays the income tax, excuse me, the capital gains tax on liquidating the assets into cash? I'm assuming the children may want to do that, especially if they have college debt or they're looking to buy a house or something like that. That would, you'd have to do an analysis with a good CPA. I'm sure he has a good CPA, but they could decide, should the children take the shares and sell, or should he sell, because he's his earnings total are $202,000. So I don't know what the kids are earning.
But well, be aware too, before you move on, just to clarify for people, the gift over the original cost basis is going to flow with those shares. So that's why there's this potential gain. And I'm sure there's people out there thinking, well, if he waits and dies and leaves it to them, there'll be a step up in basis. So that gain up to the point, any unrealized gain up to the point of his passing might flow to them then gain free. So that's also the risk that you're running, or the variable that you're dealing with. That, of course, is also under discussion in Congress about what to do with the step-up in basis, leaving it alone, restricting it, or doing away with it completely. You know, somewhere in that range is going to happen. We don't know what it is. 0 to 100, that's quite a range, right? We don't know where that's headed, but they're talking about it. So I did want to make that point, too. There is one possible downside that's clear for gifting prior to inheritance at death, is you forego the step-up in basis,
which also is on the chopping block,
as I mentioned.
Oh, perhaps I need to pay attention more when you're talking.
Yeah, that's all good.
Okay.
A lot of those words I just used there was talking about that.
There's a lot of words. I was like, yeah, whatever. Let me finish figuring this out. Okay. So I will pay attention, folks, more accurately to what Chris is saying.
Lean back a little. You're getting a little excited. So,
oh, I'm getting excited. All right, I'll lean back. All right. Here's the reason, Chris, he's thinking of giving his children $3 million. This will lower our adjusted gross income for IRMA tax purposes when we turn 65. What do you think of my idea? Okay.
Worth considering.
I think IRMA is the tail wagging the dog. That's the least of your concerns.
Oh my gosh,
here.
You nailed that.
Of course, the tail wagging the dog. I knew that.
I know. Well, longtime listeners know that's not necessarily reliable, but I wanted to give you kudos when it's due. You perfectly used tail wagging the dog.
Excellent. Yeah, you never know what's going to come out of my mouth, folks. So I don't think IRMA is what he should be looking at. As I read this email, I have got all these planning strategies, Chris, running through my head, as well as I'm sure they're running through your head. And I'm thinking there's a lot going on here.
Well, I'll say, I think you should look at IRMA along with everything else in total. I think then he will find that the IRMA decision is small potatoes in the grand scheme of things, but that it should all be included.
He can earn more on $3 million than he's ever going to owe in an IRMA penalty.
Yeah.
So we the first question would be, when you're looking to gift money while alive, is make sure you don't need it. So I went and I says, okay, wait a minute. Right now he's got $8.3 million. He only needs $100,000, he said. So if he needed $100,000 a year from his $8.3 million, he only needs to withdraw 1.2% a year of his liquid portfolio. He could put his money in fixed annuities and never have to worry for the rest of his life. So he is definitely in a very good position. That $100,000 is going to be reduced by his very generous Social Security. Once it's on at 70, he's going to be getting nearly half of that $100,000 in Social Security alone, lowering his withdrawal percentage even more. So can he afford to gift $3 million? Yes, I think he can. What do you think, Chris?
Given what we know about him, I agree. There's obviously, he hasn't given us everything that we would look at before we made a final recommendation along that route, but all indications are I'm right on board with you.
So let's look at his first thing. If you simply want to reduce Irma and you're thinking, goodness, I'm going to have to pay a couple of thousand dollars more per year per person on my wife and I in Medicare premium surcharges, how can I do that? I'm being stuck doing this because I amassed this darn $4 million in a brokerage account. Just damn the bad luck. If I didn't have that $4 million, I wouldn't have to worry about this. So you're thinking, all right, let me just get rid of $4 million and you're going to gift it. If that's your purpose and that's truly what you're just thinking of, I think you can do it. I don't think you need the $3 million. But is that the wisest thing to do? I'm not certain. Mm-hmm. But before I go into a few ideas I had, one thing I do want to mention to this listener and any listener contemplating giving any money to a child, you want to help them, and that I know. You have one daughter in med school. I'm guessing, listener, you yourself were a physician. I have no idea if your other two children are physicians or not. But giving them $1 million outright, I would not recommend. I would recommend you put it in a trust for them. Each other can be trustee of each other's account. You can have one child be trustee of the other, another child be trustee of the other. You can have both children trustee of each other's trusts. Why? Well, first of all, physicians, as you know, as I think being one, but at least we know one of your daughters is going to be a physician, are in an industry or in a career that they could be sued personally. That's why you guys have, we call it E&O, what do they call it? Malpractice insurance. Putting it in a trust will help protect the children from being sued, from divorce, from bankruptcy, from creditors, from any number of things. So I would encourage you to consider a trust for protecting those assets. And you would want to talk to a good estate planning attorney on that rather than just giving them $1 million each. The trust can have language that will allow the children to pretty much do what they want. But the minute something bad might happen, a malpractice claim, a divorce, an accident in an auto, and now they're being sued. Maybe they go into business with someone and they have to declare bankruptcy. The minute something bad happens, the trustee, which will most likely be the other children or you and your wife if you wanted to, the trustee can instantly protect the assets from any type of lawsuit. So that would be one thing I'm going to encourage rather than just gifting $1 million outright, which I think you can afford to do. So that's not the issue. Put it into the trust. Any thoughts on that? I don't want to get too deep into the pros and cons of a trust, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's prudent, especially given their ages. There's a lot of their situation now might be predictable and maybe non-threatening, but being in their 20s and 30s, lots can change. And you can't possibly anticipate everything, and you can't assume just because everything's quiet now, it will remain that way. And I think it would be absolutely prudent if you're going to give them a large lump sum to do it through the protection of a trust. Yes.
Okay. The next thing that I want to mention is if your true aim, because it's the only one you mentioned to us, was to lower the potential of you having to pay Irma surcharges. That's what you're fixating on. If your true aim is that, you could gift the money or move some of the money if you wanted to into more tax efficient investments that won't generate more than what you need to live on. And that will accomplish the same thing. Irma, he never mentions that his main goal is gifting this money to his children while they're alive and watching them enjoy it. It's, hey, I want to get rid of Irma. So I just want to point out to him that if getting rid of Irma is your aim, you can do that by simply reconfiguring the assets that you're holding.
Right.
And you can also use, because again, listener, I'm guessing you have this money invested in some type of dividend paying or REITs or real estate or something in order to be earning about 3.54% in these low interest rate environments. You can also use a variable annuity. And before people start throwing eggs at their phone, their podcast, and then screaming at us because I said the variable annuity word.
A very specific kind of variable
annuity. Yeah. I am not talking about a broker-sold variable annuity. Could you imagine? Oh, my God. You'd give a broker a heart attack.
Hey,
if
I'd like
you
to,
said, yeah. I'd like to put $3 million in a variable annuity, please. Yeah.
He'd start shopping for a new boat that day.
Oh, my God, he would. He would be, honey, we're getting a Mercedes. No, I'm not talking about going to a broker and buying a commission-based variable annuity. There are a lot of fee-based variable annuities that are nothing more than an annuity wrapper. They don't pay the agent anything, one red cent for putting you in it. Now, those agents will also then say, okay, you're not going to pay me anything, but I charge 1% to manage it. Try to find someone who's not going to charge you an outrageous amount to quote-unquote manage it or open it yourself. But you could put it in a wrapper. Those are the type of VAs we use. Now, years ago when I was a broker, and those weren't even around years ago. When I first started, folks, those didn't even exist.
Right.
But now they do, and that's what we would use. If you were our client and you were thinking, hey, Jim, I never thought of that. Now, if you go to move the money into a variable annuity, you cannot move shares. You can only move shares if you're gifting it to your children. You would have to move actual cash. So it would take looking at your investments closely. Since they're in a maybe taxable account, I'm sure there is some reinvested dividends. I'm sure there's gain. I don't know what your basis is, but you could specify shares that have the lowest taxable gain as possible, if any, if you're just selling basis, to get the money into a variable annuity wrapper. Now, I will point out, once the money is inside a variable annuity wrapper, and again, not a broker-sold one, but a fee-based is what they're called in the industry, commission-free they also go by. I don't like using that verbiage for a variety of reasons. I'll explain it later. But these are fee-based annuities that don't pay the person putting you in them one red cent. So that's the one that I'm talking about doing.
And the reason he's talking about that, because I don't think you made that clear, is that once it's inside this wrapper, that's going to suppress that yearly recognition of income that's happening when it's outside the wrapper inside the regular brokerage account. So that's what we're trying to accomplish here, since we were targeting, by his own words, he's worried about Irma, trying to suppress that. Here you could have investments. He can't shove it into one of those retirement accounts because of contribution rules, but the VA wrapper would give some of that tax control, if you will, that you don't have outside of the wrapper.
Thank you. I did not mention that. I would have mentioned it in what I'm about to say, but yes, I was assuming everybody knew that. Chris is 100% spot on. What I was getting at, and the reason I was telling him to do that, by using a variable annuity, he can still buy equities, he can still buy REITs and things like that, because I'm guessing that's what he owns now. So he can still buy that inside this wrapper, if you will. But the gain is taxed, but it's not taxed until you take it out. I would do this strategy, but there is a huge downside to it, folks and listener. All that gain continues to grow inside the annuity. You never have to take it out. There is no required minimum distributions, but there is never, ever a step up in basis, assuming the law doesn't go away.
Right.
There is never a step up in basis on money inside a variable annuity, the growth inside a variable annuity or any annuity, not just a variable annuity, because the IRS considers your annuity IRD. Y'all should know what that means. Income with respect to a decedent. IRD is also inside an annuity. We never really talk about that much on the show, but it is IRD. IRD never gets a step up in basis and is always taxed as income. So even though he can do this, he will lose a step up in basis. Mm-hmm. He will lose capital gains treatment,
right,
which may be zero if you do it correctly, or maybe 15%, maybe with the changes that they're looking to bring in. It may go up to 18 or 20. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. But
there's no silver bullet. There's always a trade-off. You have to assess the trade-offs, make sure that the advantages you view as more worthwhile and valuable to you than the disadvantages. There's not oftentimes a solution to a problem that is nothing but good news. Sometimes there is, but it's actually pretty rare, I think. There's always some kind of consequence or offsetting trade-off that you need to be fully aware of. And this is one of those cases.
Which brings me to my other thought when I was looking at this. Even if he gifted Chris the $3 million, I'm not a huge fan of the variable annuity, but I wanted to mention it, that this is an option to be done. We have used that strategy in the past, but it's usually for a specified time period we're looking to reduce someone's taxes for. So they put money in a variable annuity for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then we're going to start liquidating it and getting it back out in a tax advantage manner. In other words, we were just looking for a period of time, a brief window, right, where we wanted to lower his taxes. Let's say he wanted to do massive conversions. You can see where I'm going to go with this in a second. Let's say he wanted to do massive conversions, listener, and goodness, that $200,000 of income every year that's being generated is getting in the way of doing some nice conversions. Well, we could put it in an annuity for a couple of years and then slowly begin ruling it out tax advantage. So you can kind of see where I'm going with my next thoughts. My next thoughts are this, listener. Even if you gifted the money to your children, you would solve your problem until age 72. Then at 72, your $3.6 million IRA may have grown over the next decade. I don't know. Could it have doubled to 7.2? Could it have grown to 5? Could it have dropped to 1? I don't know. But could you imagine if it grew over the next decade, Chris?
Yeah.
Could you imagine what a $4, $5, $6, $7 million IRA is going to do to his IRMA? It's going to send it to the roof.
Yeah.
So you might be able to solve, if your problem truly was IRMA and you're looking to reduce IRMA by gifting money to your children, I think you're going to buy yourself time, but you're not going to solve the problem. So I'm fixating on the $3.6 million in the IRA as a more permanent solution, but also I think a win-win for you and your children. If you're willing to give up $3 million, listener.
I know right where you're going.
Then I'll let you take over. Where do you think I'm going? Because I know you know where I'm going, so I'm going to let you take over.
Instead of giving him that, you're going to take that brokerage money and use it to do big, massive conversions on that IRA.
Exactly. You're going to solve two things. You're going to get rid of your brokerage account.
Not rid of it. It's not going to eat the whole thing
up.
But it's
right. It's not going to eat up the whole thing. No, it's not going to cost $4 million in taxes to convert $3 million in an IRA. Right. You hit the nail where I'm going with this, especially because I feel strongly his children are going to be as successful as him and his wife. With one in med school, maybe I'm reading too much into the other two. Maybe they never went to school and they're doing something. I don't know, I don't want to say doing something because then we get nasty emails from people who do that. But maybe they're not earning as much and are going to be as successful. But if they are as successful as you are, having them inherit a Roth IRA would be wonderful. Getting all of that $3.6 million into a Roth so there's no RMDs, and in the process, lower your brokerage account, as Chris said, by using that money to pay the taxes. You were willing to get rid of $3 million, give a $500,000 or $800,000 to the government. Then if you still want to give your children the difference, you can, because you just help them tremendously, hopefully 20, 30 years from now when you pass away and they inherit it. But also, Chris, being a Roth and it grows to $3, $4, $5, $6 million, he can gift from that whenever he wants without any tax implications. So you can help your children if and when they need it in the future. You can help grandkids if and when they need it in the future. You can, by getting that money into a never taxed Roth. He essentially told us, Chris, I am willing to get rid of $3 million to reduce Irma. I like that strategy better. What are your thoughts?
I like it. The question will be, how aggressive can he get during doing this? I think a good tax projection will help dial this in. I love the concept overall. I just think it might need to be fine-tuned with more specific analysis. So I would use, you know, somebody competent to do some tax projections for you to really look at it. But I think you can kill a lot of birds with this one stone technique.
Yeah, essentially, listener and listeners, what I delivered was a stick and a pocket knife. And I told you what I'm going to do with it, but I haven't started to create what I want to out of that stick. You need a plan. You got to talk to a good financial planner. You got to talk to a good a CPA who can start doing some of the tax projections, like Chris said. You've got 4 more years under the current tax rules to start doing that. Any money that might be gifted outright, a good CPA should be able to. And if you can't find one, our firm can help you with this. And again, it's not, we very rarely say to call us for this, but this is a very specialized group of calculations we're telling you to do. If you can't find someone to do it for you, just reach out to us and I can put you in touch with Bob. But what I'm getting at, Chris, if you can determine about how much of your money you're going to need to cover the taxes over the next 4 years, I want to get it converted in 4 years while the Tax Cuts and Job Act are still in effect. So how much are we going to need over the next 4 years to do the conversions? The difference between the two, you can start gifting to some of your children now if you would like to. It's not going to take the full $3 million to get that $3.6 million IRA into a Roth. The only other thing that I would say, you probably do not have to convert into a Roth any money in an IRA that you might want to gift on an ongoing basis to a charity. Because once you reach age 72, and RMD, actually 70 and a half, before RMDs even begin at 72, or if they push them out to 75, like some politicians are trying, you can start gifting $100,000 a year from your IRA to a charity, 100% tax-free. You never have to declare it as income under a QCD, so it's never going to cause you to be subject to IRMA. So if you are also, again, let's assume you are a physician and you want to continue to give to the school you got educated at or the hospital you used to work at or something like that, and you wanted to help them annually, you can do that through your IRA and never have. Why convert only to then take it out of a Roth and give it to them? Don't convert any money that might go to a charity. Any other thoughts? I mean, that's what ran through my head when I looked at all of this.
Yeah, that all makes sense, I think.
Okay.
Definitely things to consider. There's not, obviously, we're not doing a precise recommendation here. That's not what this is all about, but definitely some food for thought if you're in a similar circumstance.
Okay. This next email has to do with very similar, but much, much, much shorter. I have a follow-up question to your gifting podcast. How does the IRS view gifting physical property, not money? For example, could I buy an adult child's car for $40,000 and give it to them? Or could I buy it for myself as if it's mine, and then when the sale is done, just sign the title over to them? What if I was to call the car a birthday gift or a wedding gift? Can I give it to them? What about buying them a house or a condo or a rental property? Well, what if I give them expensive art and jewelry? Here is someone trying to get around the gift tax rule. Do you want to burst their bubble or do you want me to burst their bubble?
It is pretty simple. It's, you know, following the rules. Any of that is gifting. So any of that, if it exceeds the annual gift tax exclusion, which is currently $15,000 per Social Security number holder, is how that works. You're supposed to report it, and it'll eat away at that $11.7 million, roughly, that we're talking about as far as the lifetime gift and estate tax exclusion number. So most people are never going to come close to eating up that lifetime exclusion amount. So it's really just a question of, am I going to have to file a gift tax return in the year that I make this gift? But the thing with the car, that was all the same thing. Whether you buy them the car or you buy it for yourself and give them the car, or you give them the money and they go buy a car, in the eyes of the IRS, that's all the same event. So anything gifted of value over $15,000, that's a reportable gift. If you stay under that, no reporting necessary. Doesn't go against anything that year. Doesn't go against your lifetime exclusion number. But over 15, you report it. May or may not make a difference in the long run, other than the annoyance of having to file the gift tax addendum to your tax return.
Okay, perfect. Sorry to burst the bubble on that. I like the train of thought, but they're on to that. If it was that easy, everybody, you want to gift someone a $3 million, $1 million each child, just go out and buy something that's worth $1 million, give it to the kid and say, hey, sell this. That way we won't have to pay any gift tax on it then. It doesn't work that way. They're on to that. So anyways, okay. How much time do we have left?
We could do one more quick one, but we've hit an hour.
So. Okay. This is a pretty quick one. It's an old email. Came in just before my stroke last November, but it's a quote-unquote George from the fine state of New York. I'm 62 and married and just retired from a state position. I receive a pension of $80,000 a year. My wife will continue to receive this as a surviving spouse after I pass. Mm-hmm. I have about $700,000 in a 403B and about $400,000 in cash. Our minimum dignity floor is $80,000 a year, which is basically fully covered by our pension. So they have a pension, folks, that fully covers their minimum dignity floor. He didn't say if there's anything left over beyond that. He will collect Social Security, so I'm guessing when you factor his Social Security on top of the pension, he more than covers his minimum dignity floor. So he has a quick little question.
One thing I'll say before the pension, if it has a cost of living adjustment or not, will be a big factor in whether you can, quote, consider the minimum dignity floor covered well just with that. It may not cover it well for long if there's no adjustment. Although, if he's got Social Security, that's going to give him a bump. So maybe between the two, he's good to go. But I wouldn't check the box MDF covered with just the 80 grand unless we knew a little more about it. And even with the cost of living adjustment, it's almost certainly never going to keep up with the minimum dignity floor.
True. Good point. Okay. They have $700,000 in a 403B, as I said, folks, and $400,000 in cash. Mm-hmm. Okay. My question is, I have three term life insurance policies that will all pay to my wife if I were to pass away. They are at three different policies. One ends in October of 2021, so one ends this year, and I hope he's still alive to enjoy this answer. $300,000 that would be paid out if he dies before October of 2021. $500,000 if he dies before October of 2024. And $200,000 if he dies before October of 2032. After that, all the term policies expire. So altogether, he's got about $1 million of term coverage. He wants to know this. What if I die while all three are still in effect? What would be the best way for my wife to invest this proceed in order to pass it on to our four children and their families? Well, a couple of things that I wanted to mention on this, very similar kind of similar, not very similar, to the question we just answered on gifting of the $3 million. He never indicates, Chris, if his main goal is helping his wife have a little extra money. He does share that their pension, which will be in full, covers the minimum dignity floor, albeit your caveat that you mentioned. He does say that when they begin collecting Social Security, he is going to receive $3,100 a month, his wife $1,500 a month. So that wasn't even part of the pension covers my full $80,000. So when you factor that Social Security in at his death, the $1,500 a month goes away, but the $3,000 a month continues. So the $80,000 pension plus essentially almost a $46,000 survivorship Social Security benefit in today's dollars more than covers the minimum dignity floor and may even cover a lot of the fund spending, especially at the death of one spouse. The surviving spouse generally isn't going out and living it up. So I'm wondering if the aim is to ultimately get the money to the children so he could name the children as primary beneficiary. It doesn't have to go through the spouse. Or maybe his aim is, well, wait a minute, maybe she might need it, so I don't want to send it to the children right away, so I want it to go to her first, and then after, ultimately, to the children. Those, to me, are the only two scenarios. Can you think of any other scenario?
Yeah, I would prefer her as primary beneficiary, the kids or trusts for the kids as contingent, because then you could do the old disclaimer strategy.
So you wouldn't have to worry about a disclaimer here. You could. Chris is 100% correct. But disclaiming is often done with taxable IRAs, mm-hmm, right, so you can avoid the taxation issue at the first beneficiary. Since life insurance is received 100% tax-free, the money could go to the spouse, and then she could physically put it into a trust for the children if she wanted to. So you don't necessarily have to disclaim in that situation.
I was thinking more autopilot-wise, where the it's set up, the trust is set up, ready to go, or the kids are already ready for it. The spouse just has to make the decision, I'm going to disclaim, and then they don't have to deal with it anymore. It just flows directly where ultimately it wanted to go. So I agree with you, though. Since there's not this tax ramification you'd normally face on, say, an IRA using this technique, it'd be easier for her to take it and then deal with it. But, you know, the contingent approach would be a little more automatic.
Right. So whether or not you do a disclaiming or give it to the spouse, to me, is immaterial. I don't quite know, though, what his ultimate aim is. So I'm going to encourage him to really talk with his spouse, talk maybe with his children as well, if they're ultimately trying to get it to them. Try to decide, do you want to give some? It doesn't have to be all or nothing, listener. You can give half to your spouse and split the other half amongst your children. You can do it that way. You can give it all to your spouse and let her decide every year if she wants to give any to the children or if she needs it for her own retirement. His ultimate question, though, was how do you invest it? To me, that was the minimum question. That's why I downplayed it. You need, and you didn't explain to me what your ultimate goal is. You need to first figure that out and then make a decision if you want it to go to the spouse, go directly to the children, go to both the spouse and the children. As far as how your spouse should invest the money, and he always said to go to the children and their families, not because she might need it. He just said, what is the best way for my wife to invest in order to pass the money on to our four children and their families? That makes me believe that him and his wife don't think they're going to need this money.
It kind of implies she would be planning to hold it until she passes, though, and she wants to invest it ultimately to give it to the kids. It's hard to tell for sure, but yeah, that's kind of the way I read that or listen to that. I didn't read it.
As far as how to invest it, if your wife does take the inheritance and ultimately her goal is to pass it on to the children, in other words, she doesn't need it, she can first think about gifting while alive. We say this all the time. why wait until you're dead and gone and then you can't watch your four children and grandchildren enjoying the largesse you're leaving them? You don't have to give it to them only as you at death. But if your wife is worried that she might need it, especially for long-term care, although with an $80,000 pension in today's dollars and $36,000 in Social Security in today's dollars, that is more than enough to cover long-term care, even in the state of New York, where you're from, a very expensive state. So her pension and Social Security is kind of a long-term care policy for her. It would only be if she's going to try to stay in the home and cover her expenses in a home and hire someone to come in to help her. But I think your other assets might be adequate. So I'm not, again, 100% sure what ultimately you're trying to do. But if she's going to hold the assets like you literally wrote it in your email to me, and these are earmarked for your children in the future, what she would want to do after you pass away is tell your children that I have these assets. I want them to go to you. How would you like me to invest them for you? What is your risk tolerance? You looking to try to grow this money during the rest of my life? Do you want to keep this money very safe? So you're guaranteed at least the $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 I'm earmarking to each child. What is the aim there? If it's literally not for her, have her ask the beneficiaries. But if it might be needed for her and you're only looking to give anything left over to your children, she has to invest it, Chris, based on what she is personally earmarking those assets for. If those assets are earmarked for something that may never happen, she might be comfortable taking a little more risk with it, assuming she has the risk tolerance. If she needs those assets at any time, at the drop of a hat, she needs it very liquid and safe, she may not invest them at all. So she has to look at the purpose of those assets. We call it positioning. She has to look and decide what these assets are going to be used for and invest them appropriately. But I'm just trying to get him to look beyond the pale and beyond the box. Is the pale? Is that correct? Beyond the pale?
Beyond the obvious. So.
Beyond the obvious. Whatever. I thought I always heard beyond the pale for something.
That it is for something, but I don't think it applies here.
Doesn't apply here. All right. Sorry, listeners.
It's offensive.
Beyond the pale is offensive?
Mm-hmm.
To who? Who would get offended by that?
No, not the statement. It's you're describing something that's offensive.
Oh,
that's fill in the blank is beyond the pale. Yeah.
Oh, no, that doesn't apply here at all.
Exactly.
Sorry, folks. didn't mean to go down that rabbit hole. But anyways, back to what I was trying to say. So that's how those assets should be invested. Do you agree or disagree with that?
That's the considerations you should make, yeah, to decide on how it should be invested, yes. There's not just a point blank simple answer to that. It all depends.
Yeah, it all depends. And the final thing, listener, if you are sending this email because you have term policies, but your health has declined and you feel you may not live beyond the term of these terms, that you may die somewhere, may not die in October when the first one expires, but you feel you may pass away before October of 2032 when the last one expires. Most term policies have a conversion feature where you can convert them before they expire into a permanent insurance policy without any proof of insurability. Your premiums will rise, but they will use the insurance company, if your policies offer it, they will use the health rating that you were originally assigned when you bought the term policies. So you would call the insurance company, you say, I would like to convert this. They'll give you an idea what the price will be. It will not be their cheapest permanent policy. So do keep that in mind. They know that. But they'll give you a price of what it will cost to convert them without proof of insurability and using the original health rating you had, not the health rating you would get now. And they'll give you a price. And sadly, if you do have a shorter life expectancy, and that's why you're asking about this, you may want to consider doing that, especially because the first term to expire in a few more months, Chris, is $300,000. So that's some serious cash there. So do keep that in mind. The policies will have a limit on the age that you can convert up to. Some have no age limit. Some I've seen age 70. You're only age 62. Some allow you to convert up until the last year or two before the policy expires, which would negate in your situation. Most don't have that and let you convert right up to when the policy ends, as long as you're not over a certain age. There's all different rules depending on what carrier it is you have. So I would get a hold of the insurance company or the agent, if they're still around, and start asking them these questions, especially if, sadly, you have a shorter life expectancy and you're wondering now. I just wanted to throw that
out
there.
Yeah, that's a good point, and good point for anyone that has term insurance that's coming towards the end of the term, but your health has taken a severe turn for the worse. It's always good to investigate your choices for turning that into a permanent policy instead. Even obviously the premiums are going to go way up compared to what you were paying for the term. But, you know, sometimes the beneficiaries of life insurance, it makes sense for them to pay those premiums, for, you know, what they might expect to be a short period of time if your health really has degraded. So something to not just ignore. I know when your health degrades, there's a lot of things to worry about, but this is one to not let it lapse, because once the term is over, no more convertibility, and you'd be, you know, wouldn't be able to get life insurance anymore likely if your health is degraded severely. So always something to keep in mind before the term policies expire if your health has really gone downhill.
Right. A lot of people with term policies don't realize most, not all, most, though, have a provision to convert them.
Right. Perfect. Well, that brings us to the end of another Q&A show here at the Retirement and IRA Show. Jim, any final thoughts?
No, no final thoughts. I want to wish everyone a happy, I don't even know what day this plays, but happy weekend coming up. And we'll be back again next week.
Yep. If anybody wants to send in their own questions, just go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form where you can submit questions or comments. You can also email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. And he's the gatherer of questions, and it'll get to him that way as well. So we thank everybody for listening, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.